Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. The global refugee crisis has hit historic proportions, with over 60 million people displaced, and our system for humanitarian response has really struggled to keep pace. But according to journalist Ben Rollins, the underlying problems are not new. What's new is that we're paying attention. In this week's episode, you'll hear from journalist and author Ben Rollins. He will focus on the lives of refugees in Dadaab, a camp in northern Kenya. Their experience reflects the broader challenges facing the displaced everywhere. This event was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Karen Ferguson. She's executive director of the Northern California International Rescue Committee.
All righty, so thank you for joining us, Ben. So first off, clearly, I love the book, okay? And for me, it provided three different areas of reflection. It gave me a visceral glimpse of life in Dadaab, how we could even begin to imagine a very different landscape. You gave us a chance to really begin to know some of the people that were there, that live there, that make that as much a home as can be a home. And how you shared with us how they have hope and what they do when hope even becomes just a whisper. And third, you gave us a lot to think about in terms of the humanitarian quagmire that is Dadaab. In 2004, the United States Committee on Refugees and Immigrants put out a report called The Warehousing of Refugees, and that really provided a framework for starting to think about these camps as a place where people end up being shelved, and they're supposedly waiting transit to some other place, and yet they're not going anywhere. What ends up happening is that we have a permanently temporary solution. For those of us in the field in refugee resettlement, we very easily quote the durable solutions. So people will be repatriated back to their country once everything is good again. Or they will be absorbed into a second country. Or potentially they will have an opportunity for resettlement if no other option is available. And yet with Dadaab and the picture that you're painting for us, these solutions are all not viable. So I really looked at my reflections of the book as a way to begin sort of talking about how we go through it, okay? So to get us started, people often ask me how I got involved in this work and being in humanitarian aid, so I get to do it to someone else finally. So why were you drawn to Dadaab? Why were you drawn to this work?
Well, I have been working for Human Rights Watch for about 6 or 7 years already in different parts of Africa. And before that, I'd been a speechwriter on foreign affairs for the Liberal Party in the UK. And they had a relationship with the Liberal Party in Tanzania. So I worked for a year on the election campaign of a party called the Civic United Front in Tanzania. And we lost an election. And a lot of my friends in that party were arrested and detained. There was a certain amount of violence. And after that experience, Human Rights Watch hired me to work on the Ugandan elections. That took me on a journey of various elections around Africa, but I ended up working on Kenya and the Horn of Africa. And in 2010, I was dispatched to Dadaab to look at the growing refugee crisis there. And as well as interviewing lots of people and writing reports about this problem in the way that Human Rights Watch does, in terms of lots of testimonies documenting the rights that are being violated, explaining the legal framework and so on. Just on a personal and an emotional level, I was blown away by this place. Because when, Karen, you talk about durable solutions, that's the theory that's supposed to happen. Once upon a time, you went to a refugee camp, you spent perhaps 5 years, possibly even 10 years in a camp, but you had some hope that there was another life that would await you at some point. And what you have in Dadaab, if you can imagine it, is a city the size of New Orleans that's made of sticks and mud and plastic, because these tents that were provided by the UN long ago have disintegrated in the weather, in the heat and the rain. And people have therefore made their own houses, and they fence them with thorns that they've cut from the desert, hence the name, the City of Thorns. And this city has been there for 25 years. And we're now onto our third generation of people who were born in this place. and they're not allowed to leave to go into Kenya. They're not allowed to work because Kenya doesn't want the refugees taking jobs that Kenyans could fulfill. And they're not allowed to pour any concrete, build any permanent infrastructure. There's no permanent sanitation. There is no permanent roads. There's no electricity. So it's this. It is a camp, but it's also a city, and it's a very strange kind of city. So that's why I then had took a vacation from Human Rights Watch, went back, did some more research, had a sabbatical, then took extended leave, and eventually I quit my job. And I raised some money, I got a fellowship to do more research, and I spent 3 years going back and forth to the camp, getting to know the people who are described in the book. Because I was a bit frustrated with the way in which there is a particular habit of representing Africa in the foreign press, and it's a bit complacent, and it deals in stereotypes, and it presumes that the audience pretty much recognizes these things. So we think we know what a refugee camp looks like, and possibly we do. We've seen the images, you've seen long lines of tents and so on, but we have no real emotional experience of what it's like to be there. So what I wanted to do was sort of cut through some of those stereotypes and give you really up-close portraits of these characters, these people who I found fascinating and who I fell in love with and who are my friends and who have incredible lives lived out in this city. And that's very much the entree for the book.
Wonderful. Thanks. It sounds like you went to the camp even 7 times more than that. It's a lot of visits and a lot of time spent there. The camp actually started in 91, really exploding by even 92. Can you give us a little bit of a background of what was going on in Somalia that people would even be fleeing, leaving their homes, becoming refugees?
Yes, exactly that. The original refugee camps were set up in 91 when the Somali government collapsed. There was a dictator called Siad Barre, who was a military man with Marxist leanings. That government sank, and the UN and the US tried to intervene. You may remember Black Hawk Down, Operation Restore Hope, when President Bush and then Clinton sent US forces. There was a big UN presence. But after that defeat by the warlord Mohammed Adid, the US retreated, and then later the UN also pulled out. And Somalia pretty much was left to its own devices, and for the best part of the next 20 years had no government at all. To give you a very brief history, not lesson, but anecdote. In 2005, the warlords had pretty much fought themselves to a standstill, and what emerged was something called the Union of Islamic Courts. And this was Sharia courts, which are basically family law courts, local courts that had united, which were backed by some militias, and they had brought some semblance of peace to Somalia, and people were actually quite optimistic at that point. Unfortunately, one of that coalition went on Al Jazeera and said some inadvisable things about jihad against Ethiopia, which, if you understand the history of Somalia and Ethiopia and Somalia have been at war many times, you would understand that comment. Unfortunately, the Bush administration didn't like that, and they wrote the Ethiopian government a blank check and told them to invade Somalia and get rid of the Islamic Courts Union, which they did at terrible cost, awful human rights abuses, which are detailed in some human rights reports which are mentioned in the bibliography. But for the Somalis at that time, people I spoke to in Mogadishu, this was a complete tragedy, that actually what happened was very quickly the Ethiopians set up what's called a transitional federal government, and because the US had nobody to work with, the person who they appointed as the sort of conciliatory leader of the transitional federal government was a guy who was recently the head of the Union of Islamic Courts. So we were back to square one within a period of about 6 months, and after many, many people killed as well. And what happened, of course, then was the reaction from the deposed courts was that the Al-Shabaab militia, which was at that point a very minor player in the coalition, had a massive upswell of support, and then for most of the period of this book, from sort of 2010 to around 2013, was in control of large parts of Somalia. And that is now the dominant shape of the conflict in Somalia between Al-Shabaab and the African Union UN-backed troops who are trying to push them out.
introduce us to some of the individuals in the book. Maybe there is a story, a couple different of individuals come to my mind, like Tawani, somebody that came because of this. Could you help us understand why any one specific family, what would they have faced that made it so, with all of that political climate, they needed to leave?
There are different people in the book, and one of the people came more lately in 2010 as a result of the recent fighting with al-Shabaab, and that's called Guled. I think we'll come back to him. But the original fighting in 91, Tawane is a young man who I met and profiled in the book. He arrived in the camp age 7 on the back of a donkey cart, and his father came from Kismayu, which is in the southern part of Somalia. The Horn of Africa, that bit that points towards Saudi Arabia, is the top. And then about halfway down when you get towards Kenya, Kismayo is very near the border there. But after the Americans left Mogadishu, there were waves of what have been called by one academic clan cleansing. So not necessarily ethnic cleansing, but cleansing along clan lines. So people were pushed out from different areas of southern Somalia. Tawane was a young boy, but his father at that point knew that war was coming. And he has this very well-rehearsed story that I heard several times and that has shaped Tawane's sort of idea of Somalia ever since, that he knew war was coming and he knew that the forces were on their way. But he told his eldest sons that before they come, we've got to go and bring in the harvest because that's going to be our means of survival when we flee to Kenya or if we have to flee. The day that he picked to send his sons to go and clear the harvest was the day that, unfortunately, the army arrived a bit earlier than expected. So he sent his boys out to the field. The next thing he knew, the military were rolling through the town. He hid, and then once they'd moved on, he then had to go to the field and find his sons, and of course, they were there with a bullet in the back of their neck, both of them. So he rushed home and then began a very traumatic escape with his remaining children, his wife, both of his parents as well, across the border on this donkey cart. And they arrived in Dadaab right at the beginning when the UN was making these squares in the sand. And they were given a tent and the family made their life, started their new life there. And the interesting thing about Tawane's dad is that he always thought, this is not going to be my home. My home is Somalia. I'm a rich man. He had 2 houses. He had plenty of land back in Somalia. So when they were offered, he was offered a plot in the market to sort of start his business again and start his life again. He said, no, this is somebody else's land. We're going home again. But the story of Tawane's life is actually that he grew up in the shadow of this father who's always saying, we're going home, we're going home, we're going home. And yet it's never happened. And he's now nearly my age. He's mid-30s and he's still in the camp. And he's still sort of trying to figure out, well, he's got this story from his father about how terrible and traumatic Somalia is. And at the same time, he's got this reality of the camp. And he's, you really see his sort of mental gymnastics trying to make sense of this difficult situation.
Yeah. So if you think about Tawane growing up in the camp and living in the camp, tell us a little bit about sort of the rhythm of life in the camp. You mentioned the market is certainly a place where many things happen to many of the characters. What's the market like? What's daily rhythm like?
Well, although, again, we have these images of camps, what has emerged is a complete society. So there's a thriving market where people have invested, people have built shops, there are hospitals, they've built hotels, restaurants, there are football, soccer leagues, there are cinemas with big screens where people pay money to go and watch Premier League soccer from the UK. Everyone has their team and, there's all sorts of tussles even when those teams clash. One of the people in the book is a young man called Nisho, who works in the market, who after his father died, he didn't go to school. His mother didn't have the money that you need to buy exercise books, to buy a uniform and so on. Although education is nominally free, there is this barrier still. So he went to work in the market as a porter from the age of 13. And by the time I met him, he was nearly twice that age. He'd been working in the market for most of his life. But he started off by shining shoes. Then he started off by packing vegetables, and then he's part of the Union of Porters, which is quite an aggressive union, and they defend their territory, and they don't allow too many newcomers in. But what they do is unload and load all the trucks that come in, bringing smuggled goods from Somalia, which goes down into Kenya. So through him, you get an incredible sense of the economic reach of this place, which is actually the biggest economy between Nairobi in Kenya and Mogadishu in Somalia. So it's actually the largest economy for around 1,000 miles, mm-hmm. 500 miles in either direction. And in the market, you can buy pretty much anything. You can buy iPhones, you can buy tomatoes, you can buy, you know, secondhand trucks, petrol, which are mostly taken from the police go and sell all their surplus petrol that they get from the UN for a tidy sum. But there's all sorts of stuff going on. I mean, that's just one little tidbit, but there's so much. And the sugar is, in fact, the key thing. The sugar comes from Kenya, comes from Somalia, goes to Kenya, and it's actually controlled by the Kenyan military in collusion with Al-Shabaab to take advantage of the corrupt commodity market in Kenya, and it's worth around $400 million a year, I've discovered, subsequent to the, you know, my interest was piqued by Nisha, watching him in the market, and then I went away and started doing other research and piecing this picture together. So Dadaab has a significance for many different actors.
I mean, in one way, you start to get the feel for actually a pretty sort of thriving life, and there's market, and you can buy iPhones and everything. And yet, what are the conditions like in terms of sanitation, and what's the currency?
Yeah,
how are people buying those things?
Well, their money is moving around the camp now, but money can be quite hard to come by, especially if you don't have access to a job. So for those like Tawane who've grown up there, or Nisho who've grown up there and who've found a way of making a living in the camp, they now have access to some sort of cash. I mean, for Nisho, it's still not much. It's still only 100 or 200 shillings a day, which is around $2-3, which is enough to supplement his UN rations. So the way that everybody still eats is through the UN ration system, which is every 15 days, you go to a warehouse with your ration card, you get it stamped, and then you go through these different hangars. It's a bit like aircraft hangars, thousands of people going through every day, because there's 500,000 people in the camp. You get your flour, you get your rice, you get your beans, you get your oil, and then at the end you go and you weigh it. There's a weigher, a checker, who makes sure that it all adds up. And if you have a query and you dispute the checker's his decision,
analysis. Uh-huh.
His analysis, then you go to the community checker, who the community have lobbied to have their own person who will weigh your food and make sure that you've got just the right amount. It's not much anyway, but still, people fight about it. And the way that you get cash, as Guled, this young man who comes in 2010, who's a new arrival, he doesn't have the connections that can sustain him, that can give him any other money. The only way he can get money is to monetize his rations. So as soon as he gets his rations, and there's a whole drama, which maybe we won't go into, but it's in the book, of him actually getting to the camp and trying to figure out the camp. And he needs to call home. He needs to call his wife to tell her that he's made it to the camp. But he can only do that after 10 days, when he's registered, he's got his rations, he's taken his rations to the market, he sold some of them so he can buy a scratch card and phone, so that he can, and that, you know, and $1 to phone Somalia is a kilo of rice, which is half of his food ration. So he has to go hungry. If you want a phone call, if you want soap, if you want tea, if you want sugar, if you want vegetables, because the rations are just the bare bones of carbohydrate and protein, then you've got to go hungry. So some people, and there's a guy called Dube, who's now actually quite almost a millionaire in the camp, but he started off as a businessman by going hungry for many years, so that he could save up the capital to then start a business.
Yeah, and you know, the issue of hunger is something that I would love for us to understand a little bit more, because you get sort of this sense of the vibrancy of the place, but underneath it is this desperation. You had this specific quote in the book from one of the women, Isha. And you said, for the past 3 years, hunger had become the normal thing. Isha was familiar with the bleeding gums, the inflamed limbs, the cramped pain of drinking, the torture when the empty stomach eats itself. And yeah, I think we often nowadays have gotten sort of so used to the images that we don't understand the hunger. One of the things that was amazing to me was you describe this very severe hunger, and then you describe Ramadan, and that people fast even on top of their hunger. Now, I don't know if that, just sort of helping us to get an understanding of the businessman who sells and what that does to people's ability to function and to move forward in their lives when they're dealing with such severe hunger.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it has a strong psychological effect. And I think it also has political effects too, because people are so grateful sometimes for the food that they don't stand up for their rights. They don't query the UN when there are problems. So Isha is one of the women who walked from Somalia during the famine of 2011 with her five children for 16 days. And she only walked at the very, very last minute when she felt that she absolutely had to, because if she didn't, her children might die. So at that point, she started walking. So the children were already very weak. And they walked for 16 days, and the soles of their feet were shredded because of the sand. They had to walk at night because it was cooler then. And the precious water that she had, she was only giving them a tiny bit to drink. And the rest she was wetting a rag and wrapping it around their feet because their soles were so sore. But by the time they get to the camp, in 2011, the camp was exploding. So there was already, this is a temporary city, right? The size of New Orleans with these, in fact, it's five suburbs that are linked in a sort of a semicircle. And at that time, there was then all these temporary suburbs that were springing up on the edge because all these people were coming, and Kenya had said, the camp's full, no more people. So they were not allocating any new space for anybody. So Isha and her kids are surviving on the charity of other refugees on the edge of the refugee camp for 21 days before they can get to the UN and register and get their cards and get their food. So by the time they get their food, they're on their last legs. But there's, you know, she's very grateful. She feels that this was the right thing to do. All of the children survive. She was lucky, because there were many of her friends whose children didn't survive. Mm. And it means that people are, in a way, very, very humble. I mean, some of the refugees who've been there longer are much more assertive about their rights, but certainly the newcomers are incredibly fearful of upsetting the UN because they're worried that the rations might get taken away again.
Yeah, and you talk about the change that happened in the camp over the period of time from when it started to starting in 2011 when this explosion happened, and yet the camp both wasn't ready and because of various other factors wasn't going to be ready for a tremendous upsurge in people so quickly, and so rations start to get cut. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit about the change that happens in the camp from sort of that beginning part to what it looked like in the later?
Well, you may be familiar with the famine, images of famine that happened in 2011. ABC News Nightline was from Dadaab, live from Dadaab. Anderson Cooper, CNN, was live from Dadaab. And that was definitely a big change in the life of the camp. But what I've tried to do in this book is to actually show you that change from the perspective of the people who were already there. So Nisho, we'd already talked about Nisho, he was in the market, and for him the famine was a boom. He was in the market unloading, loading all this new food, all this equipment. There was free stuff getting distributed indiscriminately so that the agencies could say that they had had impact, that they had distributed X many tents to X many refugees. So he was stocking up, and he was getting paid really well for doing all this unloading, and he was saving loads and loads of money during the famine. So he sees Angelina Jolie, sees Kanan, sees all these people coming, but he, in the meantime, has a different story going on. And he actually used the famine to save a lot of money. And he managed to get himself on a list for camels that the government of Turkey was donating for Eid. But in a deal with the community, they said, well, the camels are going to get eaten and they're going to get shared anyway among the refugees. So why don't we have a double whammy? Why don't we say, why don't we kill two birds with one stone? We'll say that we'll allocate some of these camels for bride price, because a big problem in the camp is that all the young men can't raise the money to get married. So Turkey, at a stroke, won millions of admirers in the camp by not only feeding refugees, but also enabling a select group of people who managed to wangle their way onto the list the chance at marriage. So Nisho was armed with a camel and his savings, but then he had to find a bride. And the camels were all due to be slaughtered on Eid, so the clock's ticking. So there's a crazy story that Nisho has 3 weeks to find a bride. But it has to be one who will accept a camel and his meager savings, which is not enough because he's from a minority clan, Rahawain clan, which is looked down on by some of the others. So he can't afford the girl that he likes. But in the end, he does find a cut price bride among the newcomers who, and I mean, he says it himself. I just quote his own words, but he says, you know, I got one for cheap. And but she's lovely, and they get it together, and they have a marriage on the Eid at the famine. So it's in the middle of the famine. It's Eid. It's the end of Ramadan, and Nisho is the happiest man alive, and it's the best day of his life, and all this other stuff is going on all around it. But it just shows you that, you know, there's a whole. This is a very rounded picture. You know, in the middle of all that suffering, there's also this other stuff going on.
Yeah. So I'll incorporate some of the questions that you're starting to send up just so that we don't steer too far away from the conversation. So that whole idea of the economy and the entrepreneurs that take advantage within these situations, some rightly so. So a question of, do small businesses exist, as well as banks, et cetera, within the refugee camp? Could you maybe describe even the economy of those a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Well, the best way I can answer that is to give you the story of this man called Dube, who runs a restaurant, who started off by going hungry in order to raise the capital to buy a shop. And now his restaurant is famous in the camp. He also has made a lot of money through renting vehicles to the aid agencies. And his sons won the resettlement lottery, because it is a bit like a sort of green card lottery. There are very few people who get accepted for resettlement. So his sons won the resettlement lottery to California, and he got the news that they were cleaning toilets in California, and he wasn't happy about that. So he went into his savings, and this is the issue of banks. There are no banks in the camp. Right. So he dug up the dollars that he had buried in the sand in his compound, because that's where everybody puts their money. And he sent by the Dahab Shield, which is like the Somali Western Union money wire service, he sent $75,000 to San Francisco, in fact, so that his sons could buy a 12-wheeler truck to start a transportation business that was much more honorable than cleaning toilets. And I talked to the guy in the Dahab Shield money wire office in the camp, and he said, I've seen lots of money coming the other way, but I've never seen it going that way. I've never seen dollars going to America.
Yeah, that is sort of unusual. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you do talk about the fact that many people are taking anything they have and sending it to family that isn't in the camps, to other people as well, to take care of them.
Yes. I mean, the thing is that there's a differential population in the camp. So there are some people who are quite well off, who've been there for a while, but they're still stuck. They still can't go back to Somalia, either because of the war or because of personal trauma, or they can't go to Kenya because Kenya doesn't want them either. So there's a roadblock, several roadblocks south of Dadaab. You can't go to Nairobi, down into Kenya. You get sent back again. But it's you know, it's part of the Somali world. I mean, those of you who are from Somalia or who know Somalia, most people know somebody in Mogadishu. Most people know somebody in Dadaab. It's like, you know, when I go to foreign countries and I say I'm from England, oh, I have a friend in London. Of course, it's the third biggest city in Somalia. So it's very much a part of that network and that diaspora.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from author and journalist Ben Rollins. He's in conversation with Karen Ferguson. She's with the International Rescue Committee. This event was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to share this episode or register for an upcoming event or to join the World Affairs Council. And now back to our conversation.
I'd like to just take a moment and talk about women, because you have some really amazing women in the book as well. And I would assume possibly have some different trajectory in terms of life in the camp and what they struggle with. Maybe start us out. Help us know one of the women a little bit more.
Well, Cairo is probably the most interesting young woman. She was born in the camp. She her mother was very clear that she was going to go to school, and her mother carried firewood in the camp for 19 years in order to buy her uniforms and supplement their diet and to buy her batteries for her torch so that she could study at night. And batteries are relatively expensive, so that was a big sacrifice. And when she graduated from primary school, there was a big party that she was then going to go to secondary school, because very few kids get to go to secondary school. The slots are very narrow, not very many spaces to go to secondary school. Even primary school enrollment is not great, but it's a bit broader than secondary school. And the reason why getting into secondary school is such a big deal is because one of the few legitimate ways out of the camp is to get a scholarship to study a bachelor's degree in Canada. Canada is the only country that has this thing called a WUSC program, the World University Service Canada. And everybody in the secondary school dreams of Canada. So for Cairo, it was very important that she studied, but also that she didn't get married, that she avoided the temptations of men and husbands, because her education was important. And the other thing that's interesting about her story and the sort of side effect of the UN bureaucracy in the camp is that it's quite empowering. So she was very clear to me that if I was in Somalia, I wouldn't have had the chance to go to school. This is a fantastic opportunity that I've had in the camp. Also, that the power of the clan is much diminished in the camp, because, again, at home, I probably wouldn't have had any choice. I would have been told, you're not going to school, you're getting married. But in the camp, the clan doesn't have that kind of purchase, so she can't be forced. And also, her and her mother decided that she wasn't going to be circumcised, which was, again, something that may well have happened if she had been back in Somalia. To cut a long story short, unfortunately, she didn't make the cut for the scholarship. WUSC takes the top 10 boys and the top 10 girls. And she accepts. She's very sad and depressed for a while, but she accepts it, and she ends up being a teacher in the camp. But what's interesting about that is that many of the volunteer positions that are available for the refugees, they're not allowed to work, but the UN has sort of fudged it. They allow them to volunteer, and then they pay them a stipend. But the stipend is only about $70 or $80 a month. It's nothing compared to what the Kenyan staff get paid for doing the same job. But there are many more women employed in these incentive jobs than men, because the agencies have these policies of gender mainstreaming, all the sort of NGO speak that some of you may be familiar with who work in that sector. So with the gender mainstreaming, it has meant that there's a strong feeling among many of the men that they're emasculated, that they don't have the opportunity to earn money, that they no longer have the status in the clan to decide the social life of the group. And also, there are elections run by the UN, which are, again, gender neutral, open to everybody. And there are many, many women running the camp, probably more women than men, in fact, elected in the camp, who are running things, running committees, running the sections, the blocks, liaising with the UN and everything. So a side effect of this very strange society, this weird world that's been created in the camp, is that you have a whole generation that's kind of marinated in this UN right speak, and in the empowerment of women, and you have a whole generation of women that are uniquely qualified in many ways. which would be a fantastic asset if Somalia ever does get back on its feet.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to shift us a little bit. We'll go get into Guled's story a little and talk about how he ended up needing to flee and come to Somalia. Let me start there.
Guled is actually the story that opens the book. There's nine people who I talk about in the book. And he fled in 2010. He had been born around about the time of Black Hawk Down, back to the original war in Somalia. And he had survived for many years in Mogadishu against the odds when the city was, at some points when the city was absolutely deserted. Mogadishu's been bombed more times than Grozny or Sarajevo or Raqqa or Aleppo or any of these places. It's been reduced to rubble three times since 1991. And he grew up there, and he was one of 25% of kids who were still going to school in Somalia, because there are still teachers there who were very courageously trying to run things. And he went to school one day in October 2010, and in his geography class, seven armed men appeared at the back of the classroom, and they started picking out the tallest boys in the room, and he was one of them. And they took the seven kids out of the school, blindfolded them, put them in a pickup truck, and took them to an Al-Shabaab training camp just on the outskirts of Mogadishu. So Guled spent a month in this training camp, and he was forced to be part of what's called the Hizbat, which is the morality police. And these guys patrol the town and make sure that the shops are shut during the prayer time. They make sure that if you're a woman and you're wearing a dress, that it's sufficiently long and sufficiently thick, and you're not showing your ankles or your wrists. And if you're a man, that you have a decent haircut, no mohawks, no funny beards, no strange beard cuts, and also you don't wear Western trousers that reach all the way down to your shoes. You have to have cuffs that expose your ankles in the what they consider to be the traditional Somali way. Although, of course, the burqas that they're enforcing are not traditionally Somali at all. They're imported straight from Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. So he was in part of this Hizbat. And one day he managed to escape. I won't go into the details of it, but he managed to escape. And he then had to get himself. He knew that if he stayed in Mogadishu, he was probably at risk of being recaptured Al-Shabaab would exact revenge. So he knew he had to try and get to the refugee camps. He goes to see an aunt of his who gives him $50, which is what he needs to get the bus to the border, all the way down through Somalia, about 400 miles down to the border with Kenya. But when he gets to the border with Kenya, his struggles aren't over. And his story is useful to realize that the experience of being a refugee is not that you simply show up at the camp and there's a cup of tea and somebody welcoming you with a bus service from the border. In fact, the border from the border to the camp is 90 kilometers of scrub, and that scrub is policed by the Kenya police and bandits, and around one in three women who make that perilous journey are raped. Most people suffer some kind of banditry where they're robbed or the police pick them up and send them back to Somalia again. So if you can make it to the camp and you can get to the UN office and you can register as a refugee, then you're fine. But if you can't get there, then you could suffer any of these other things in between. Guled manages to smuggle himself onto a sugar truck and gets a lift to the camp, and then begins the process of trying to figure out the place and some of the places that we've described, trying to find trying to make a living in the market, trying to get his food and so on, and the story that I already told you, that long process of getting his food so that finally he can sell the food, phone his wife. Although he's a young man, he's married young. Many people during the war do get married young, partly because of the bride price issue. So he and his wife had actually eloped from school and gone to visit what they call a rent-a-sheik, who had blessed their marriage, and they paid him some money. And so they had got married on their own because they couldn't afford to do it properly. But he did all of that in order to get the money to phone her and tell her that he was okay.
Yeah. And I think for me, one of the things that Gulad's story brings up is because of everything that we're seeing with Syria. So several of you have brought up the media's focus on Syria and Syrian refugees right now. And what we're hearing is something that is very obvious in Gulad's story, which is that blurring of the line that terrorists do in terms of who is a victim and who is a terrorist. So what's your thought of how Gulad is going to be looked at by the processing agents? Is he a terrorist?
Well, that's exactly the problem. I mean, his story in the book is one of the most traumatic, in a sense. He has a whole various dramas with Mariam joining him in the camp, and then the pressures of living in the camp that puts on their marriage and the children that they then have in the camp. But at the end of the book, 3 years into my relationship with him, 3 years after knowing him, we talked about what the future held. And at that point, he was telling me, I don't have any other options. I'm going to walk to Europe. Because if you want to go to Europe the illegal way, you pay the traffickers around $10,000. But he didn't have $10,000. So he was saying, I'm just going to start walking and I'll see what happens, because I don't have any other options. He couldn't go back to Somalia. His wife was very keen to go back to Somalia because from her perspective, everybody's attitude about return is very finely balanced. So from her perspective, Mogadishu was safe. She had her mother there who could help with the childcare. As she told Gulad, at least we had a washing machine in Mogadishu. In the camp, life is really hard. She's had three kids. She's had three cesareans. She's been told by the doctor she can't lift anymore. You know, this is when you actually need to fetch your water every day. You need to fetch your rations every day. If you can't lift, you're pretty, you're in a difficult situation. So for her return, she was always playing down the Al-Shabaab threat in their domestic discussions because she wants to go back. Whereas for him, that fear was very visceral. He'd been kidnapped as a child soldier. He didn't, as a child from primary school, he didn't want to go back there. So, as I explained in the book, at the end, I intervened. I didn't intervene in people's lives very much, apart from buying them meals and things. But by the end of the research, I did intervene, and I went to the UN and talked about his case. And the problem is exactly that. Although he may have been, when he was a minor, he was a child soldier, and he would have been possibly slated for some kind of rapid resettlement out of the camp. Firstly, he didn't say anything at the time because he was scared. And secondly, even if he had have done, you then have to find a country that's willing to take him. And if you've got that sort of background, those are the people that actually most need the protection and the opportunity of resettlement. But because of this taint of what has happened to him, many countries just say no. The UN takes your case and has a sort of resettlement caseload, and it tries to find homes for some of the people who are vulnerable. And countries, of course, are at liberty to say no. Just on the resettlement point, I mean, that's some of the intricacies of the individual cases. But it's worth pointing out the overall number issue, because this is really what the lesson of Dadaab is that this global refugee crisis that we're currently in the middle of, the only thing new about it is that we're paying attention. Actually, there's very little that's new. The sort of topsoil of the Syrian numbers is fresh from the recent conflicts, but there is a bedrock of protracted refugees that has been growing and growing and growing and growing for decades. Since the 90s, the numbers of protracted refugees have been on the rise, and that's because the number of the conflicts are more intractable, so people are not going home, and also because the resettlement figures in the rich countries, North America and Europe in particular, have gone down and down and down. The US used to take tens of thousands of Somalis every year in the 90s from Dadaab. Now they take around 1,000 a year. The UK, for example, takes around 100. Sweden takes around 60. The birth rate in the camp is 1,000 a month. So there's no way these numbers are ever going to match up. And Dadaab is one city out of many cities. There's four big camps in Chad with people from Darfur. There's loads of camps in South Sudan. There's lots of other camps in Ethiopia with Somalis, also with Eritreans. Then there's Yemen. This pipeline is blocked, and the refugee quota system is not working. And what instead we have is this very politicized discussion of numbers. 4,000 a year in the UK, 20,000 a year in the US, 25,000 in Canada. But this is change compared to what all of these countries used to take in the past. And it's a problem, and that needs to be fixed.
And newcomers are still coming to Dadaab all the time.
Yes.
Why?
Yes, because of floods, because of drought, because of fresh waves of conflict, which is also connected to the environmental circumstances. And when climate change hits in 20 years, in 40 years, large parts of the Sahel are going to become uninhabitable. Already you're seeing massive climate fluctuations in the Horn of Africa every couple of years at the moment. Famine again now in Ethiopia this year. Large numbers at risk. Within our lifetimes, we're going to see large numbers of people moving north, moving south, crossing the seas. You know, parts of London might be underwater, parts of Manhattan might be underwater. We need to fix this system so that we can fairly deal with the large movement of people. Otherwise, it's going to be governed by short-term politics and fear, you know, which is already winning out in many areas.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, so we've had several questions about the fact that, you know, Syria is on everybody's mind, but how do we keep situations like Dadaab in the forefront? How do we make sure that people are not forgetting about this?
Well, the first thing to remember is that the Syrian numbers coming into Europe are a symptom of this pipeline problem. And it's because I think Syrians are looking at camps like Dadaab and they're saying, we know that that's not a temporary option and therefore we're not going to the camps. That Zaatari is one camp that gets a lot of press that looks like a city, and the boss is called a guy called Killian Kleinschmidt, who tried very hard to make it innovative. But it's the only camp that's full. All the other Jordanian camps are half empty because people aren't going there. Instead, they're getting $2,000 together and they're going to Turkey. So if you understand the Syrian crisis as a rational response to this broken refugee regime, the legal route, that's how you see it in context. And that's how you keep reminding people that this is a global problem. It's not just a Syrian problem. And it's not just a European problem either, because all countries in the world, and the United States has done a great job over the world over the years of accepting many refugees, but there are all these other emerging economies which should also be taking refugees as well. And the role of the US is not only in taking more people, but also in, you know, encouraging those other countries to take their fair share as well.
Yeah, yeah. But as you describe from Guled's story of incoming and of the thoughts that he might go forth and try to get to Europe himself, that right now those kind of processes are incredibly risky. I mean, we see the toddler washed on the shore in Greece. These are horrible journeys that people are taking. Is there something that needs to happen with that to allow people to be able to move more safely?
Well, I mean, now you're talking about EU politics at a very gritty level, and it's incredibly hard to get any agreement. There was the Mare Nostrum, this Italian patrolling of the Mediterranean to pick people up out of the sea, but that has been stopped for political reasons. That other countries, Britain being one of the worst, says that the patrolling is a pull factor, that actually the best deterrent is to let them drown and then they won't come. So, you know, there's some very nasty politics going on in Europe at the moment, and a lot of Islamophobia, which the US is not immune from. So it's a big challenge on a existential level, I think, to our own societies. I think we need to really think quite hard about the nation state and what is the nation state and what's it for, and who has a right to be there, and all this nativist ideologies that we hear, which is a word I prefer to nationalism, are nonsense, because, you know, we all came from somewhere else originally. But if we can't think of the state in a more sort of judicious ways, in more fair ways, then we're heading for a big crunch, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Coming back to the camp a little bit, there's some questions about the idea of dignity in the camp. And especially I struggle with the fact that in the later period for Dadaab right now, the food rations have gotten cut 50% and then another additional percentages. So what people are even beginning to live on or able to live on is getting smaller and smaller. The ability to survive in these places is getting smaller. What does that do for people's dignity? How do they manage to have a sense of that?
Well, some people are actually going back to Somalia because they would rather the war than starving in the camp. Because for the vulnerable, the ration, they do depend on the rations. And because of the World Food Programme crunch, the rations have been cut. So Guled, for example, is one person who was suffering because his wife was the last, at the end of the book, this is last year, his wife was pregnant again, so he wasn't eating. He was giving all of the cut rations to his wife so that she could nurture the unborn child. But some people are voting with their feet and going back to Somalia. But what they need, in fact, almost as much as food, is some sense of hope. And a lot of the book is about how people manufacture hope in the absence of any tangible future for themselves. Every day they're waking up and imagining some kind of life, whether that's Cairo thinking about Canada, whether that's Tawane thinking that he's going to be rich one day, or Nisho looking for the next truck. And what Nisho's done in a way is to sort of lower his horizon. What Cairo's done is to sort of put her life on hold. And what Tawane's done is every day to try and sort of imagine himself differently. So he has this very schizophrenic, unstable personality. And it's taking its toll, so people cope in different ways, but every day they're trying to think of something. Like, I used to ask Cairo, where are you, what's going to happen to you in the future now? And one day she'd say, well, I'm going to be a doctor and I'm going to study in Nairobi. And the next day you ask her and it's like, no, I'm going to be an accountant and I'm going to get into business. And then the next day you say, oh, well, maybe I should go back to Somalia and be a farmer. Or, ideas of herself are always constantly shifting.
Yeah, so I mean, hope is one of those pieces of the human spirit that lasts longest in most desperate situations.
Yeah.
There is a lot of talk that people in situations of dire poverty and these conditions, that's prime ground for radicalization. That's where you get the terrorists breeding. So we have a question about, isn't this sort of a picture of sort of how terrorism can grow?
Mm.
What did you see in the camp in terms of that?
Well, the prologue to the book is a meeting I had at the National Security Council in the White House in 2014. And I was there to brief them to try and explain this idea that refugee camps are not hotbeds of extremism. And it's been a common assumption, both on the left and the right, for many years that poverty and marginalization, especially embodied in refugee camps, are the sort of agar jelly, the culture in which
in the petri dish,
the petri dish in which radicalization grows.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not true. I mean, the one example, I spoke to the guy Nisho working in the market. I said to him point blank once, people say that Al-Shabaab is there offering $100 a month as a salary. You're poor. You don't have enough food to feed your wife. What about it? Why not? And he was outraged. He was really insulted. He said, how dare you? Just because I'm hungry and just because I'm poor doesn't mean I'm a nutcase. I don't want to go and kill myself. I've come to the camp to survive, to live. Why would I want to go and join the crazy guys who want to blow themselves up? That it's a death cult that has got nothing to do with being poor and hungry. In fact, it's the absolute obverse of that. And when you see daily life up close from the sort of the documentary camera that I've tried to put on their shoulders, you realize how completely marginal issues of radicalization are to their life. It's got nothing to do with it. The way in which it affects them is the counter-terrorism force from the Kenya police, or the military context of the camp, or in some very rare cases, some threats from Al-Shabaab to particular individuals who are doing particular things that they don't like. But by and large, for the youth in the camp, that just doesn't even represent an option. You do hear occasionally one boy's gone, he's disappeared, but that's often because he's been under pressure from his family, or he had mental health issues. I mean, the way I see radicalization really is much more as a mental health issue, the way that one should see extremism in the United States, all those active shooters. That's a mental health issue. Mm-hmm. That's not a radicalization issue. And it's exactly the same with Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab is a small group of 3,000 guys. And how many of them were kidnapped and co-opted like Guled? And how many of them have joined because they want the money? And how many of them are actual, you know, self-styled messiahs who really believe the crazy stuff? I don't know. Nobody really knows. But it's such a sideshow for all of these people.
Yeah. So we've described a pretty intense and vibrant economy happening in Dadaab.
Yep.
So a couple of questions. Why not just turn it into a city? Why can't the Kenyan government just sort of embrace this as part of Kenya?
Mm. Well, Kenya, like any government, is very suspicious of a large number of refugees camping on their territory. And I think there are very real reasons why they don't want it to turn into a city. They cite the security concerns, which I don't believe, but nonetheless, they think that's important. They also talk about environmental degradation. But the biggest issue is simply the xenophobia and fear that refugees must confront wherever they are. And for Kenya, this is also intimately tied up with their own history, because a quarter of northern Kenya, the whole area where Dadaab is, was historically part of Somalia. So in fact, some of these people, like Tawane's great-grandparents, used to graze their camels on that land. Mm. And now he's a refugee in another country, being told that he can't work and he's not allowed to be fully human in this place. So Kenya has a whole can of worms, a whole political can of worms, if it was to accept these refugees as permanent. Nonetheless, I think we are going to have to accept these places as permanent, and we're going to have to accept the Palestinian settlements as permanent as well, instead of this sort of this endless limbo. Because there is what I've sort of tried to outline in the book, are all of the political forces that keep this place stuck in its limbo. And I don't think that US counterterrorism policy is going to shift. I don't think Western xenophobia is going to shift. I don't think Kenya is suddenly going to open its arms and embrace all these people. Refugee law exists, but I don't believe it's going to suddenly be adhered to anytime soon, because camps are, in fact, illegal. Under refugee law, you can't keep people in camps. You're supposed to allow them to move and to work. But I don't think any of that's going to change. And therefore, I think we do need to start treating these places as cities, and we need to resource them as such and see these people as assets. I mean, it's one of the most frustrating things in this whole discussion is that the United States was built by the energy of immigrants, and every single academic economic study shows that refugees have a net economic benefit many times the cost. Why aren't we all fighting over these people? Right. I don't get it. You know, why aren't we bringing them to, like Germany? Germany's saying we've got a depopulated East, we need to regenerate it. Welcome in, you know.
Right.
And they're going to reap the benefits of it, you know.
Right.
And the rest of Europe is going to be sitting there counting their change.
On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I ask you to join me in thanking Ben Rollins for just an excellent discussion.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Featured in this episode was author and journalist Ben Rollins. He was in conversation with Karen Ferguson of the International Rescue Committee. Visit us at worldaffairs.org to share this episode or register for an upcoming event or to join the World Affairs Council. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producers Circle. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.